Welcome to Weird Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Oh, yeah.
Justin Robert Young.
Hey, friends.
Yeah, we're all friends here, right, guys? We're friends.
We're friendly. I mean, you wouldn't know it from the way we sometimes behave in our fantasy scenarios.
I totally berate Justin, the one person who's been there for every important endeavor I've ever done, and without which I would probably be living out of my car in Fort Lauderdale.
Well, and the funny part is how uniform you are about it. It's like there's no other move than besides calling him a shaved ape or a unshaved, Sasquatch. Yeah.
Well, when you're that indebted to somebody,
you got to create leverage. You know, yeah, you got to just make it anywhere you can.
Yeah. I mean, if I start being nice to him, you're going to think one of us has cancer.
So. Oh, dude.
Exactly. No, I mean, we can't worry the kids.
Yeah. So, guys, I am excited. I'm not just excited because I saw the Spectre trailer, mind you. No, I am. Did you see the trailer, Brian?
No, I haven't.
Well, I pity you.
But you're deeper into Bond than I am. You went back and rewatched all the Bonds.
Deep into Bond, yeah. No, I mean, it's been uniformly excited people. I mean,
so. Good.
But no, it's great. As for whatever you thought about Skyfall, you know, I think it was a very well made movie. It looked really, really cool. And, you know, it's kind of brought a different sort of aesthetic, I think, to the Bond franchise. I think Casino Royale did a good job in that as well. But this is awesome. It feels like its own entity. Like it feels like it is a sequel to Skyfall in what its look and everything. And like Christoph Waltz, I was kind of worried would kind of be a little bit too on the nose as a Bond villain. But the way that they have chosen to introduce him in that trailer, I think, was note perfect. It was great.
You know, there are things you want things to be when they appreciate what makes them great. And that's what's cool. But I'm not here to talk about that, guys.
No.
I'll talk about something else that has me tingly, excited.
What's that?
You know I like caves, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, you're the brave explorer. You brave young, rough and tumble ne'er-do-well adolescents in order to go to was it Bigfoot Caves? Is that what it was?
It was Ape Cave.
Ape Cave.
Which reminded me of a Bionic Man episode, but I'll forget about that. Gentlemen, and I like lava tubes. I love lava tubes. That's actually what I was in as a lava tube. Why do I like lava tubes?
Oh, because that's where we're going to live in the future, on Mars. That'll be the first place we go.
We could also live in other places in lava tubes too, Bri. Wait, Justin.
Here on Earth?
Well, yeah, but I mean other places, not this place. Gentlemen. There are some other people who understand this, have seen this. Well, I mean, people thought about this for like, you know, I think original Buck Rogers was the guy who went to sleep in a cave on the moon. Maybe not the original. Anyhow, I digress. Point is, David Blair and colleagues from Purdue University in West Lafayette, depends on what part of the where you are in the South or not the South, it's Lafayette or Lafayette, used computer modeling to determine the stability of lunar lava tubes with different widths, roof shapes.
Oh, man, I didn't even think of that. Of course.
It's the first modern reassessment of how stable these can be, he told BBC News. So what they did is they used these things called computers to model, to look at this, to look at the different type of material, to look at like the gravity, to look at the structure, to figure out how stable would it be. If you go to another planet or another moon, you know, and you want to live somewhere, you know what? You want to live probably. The lava tubes are great. The reason lava tubes are great or caves are great on other planets is because of radiation. When you have tiny, thin, or non-existent atmospheres, you're getting pulverized by space rays every single second that will fry you on the inside, that'll cook your gonads or whatever parts you have down there. And ruin your day. So you need another way to survive. So I'm not looking. Brian, because it gets better.
Okay.
It gets
all right. Better.
Okay.
All right.
The winner of the most awesome, because you think, all right, lava tubes. Okay. How cool. I mean, lava tubes. All right. I've been in like a garage or I've been in there. Like, how cool. I don't want to live in a cave like some sort of dirty mole person. No offense to mole people, by the way. Okay. It's just a perception, okay? I don't want to live like that. Who could live like that? But then we get to probably the most awesomest infographic I've ever seen relating to living inside of lava tubes or caves on a lunar surface, Brian. This one,
I love that that's a list, by the way, that he is keeping tally on, is just infographics related to lava tubes for human use.
Justin, you're gonna eat those words.
No. I celebrate. I celebrate this.
I want you to. You may now scroll down and look at this infographic.
All right, here we go.
Describe. You have to describe everything you see in your reaction.
All right. First of all, this is the BBC News. Lava tubes safe enough for moon base. You scroll down. You got a photo of a nice lava tube. I mean, that looks cozy. I wouldn't mind being in there. This is up from Hawaii.
Safe little thing, like just burrow in there for you know, hibernating.
Oh, here we go. For example, moon surface temperature can vary by several hundred degrees Celsius during the course of a lunar day. And they show you a cave entrance from Mare Tranquilitas, the Sea of Tranquility, I assume. And then, holy cow. So we've got...
Wait! Whoa. Just emotions alone. Justin?
All right. So what we see is a...
Just emotions, not facts. Just feelings.
Oh, well, all right. So, number one, because I can't really read what it says, but it just by the infographic alone, oh my God, I thought it was a battleship. It's instead Philadelphia approximated compared to, I guess, the area of these lunar tubes. And Philadelphia is like a little speck, a little like a marker drawing in the far right hand corner. That's insane.
I mean, this is extraordinary, right? So it's like you see a bubble. It's like a side cutaway view of this thing, and it looks like you could fit like five Philadelphias across it, which I can't wrap my mind around this. Even as we're saying this, this is like enough room that you have acreage to farm. You could throw a bunch of sports complexes in there. I mean, it's gigantic, and you could totally picture, you know, let's say in the next, you know, 30, 50 years, we get some kind of effective, sustainable fusion reactor. You could just have a sun, just throw a sun up on top. It's amazing.
That's insane.
So what we're looking at is the caption below says lunar lava tube should be stable up to 5 kilometers wide. In American, you know, that's like, you know, at least, you know,
like two miles.
It is quite a distance across. So it's about 3 miles across. And then they show, you see, and we're looking at it in two dimensions. So you're just seeing Philadelphia as one part of it, but we're not looking at it from the top to see the amount of area underneath there is incredible. I mean, and so what they're saying is that not only could a lava tube of that structure, that size, be stable, they also say that a lava tube of that size is possible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've never seen, I loved seeing this this cave entrance photo. That to me is the more visceral of the images because I don't think of things like there being, I don't think of the moon, of course, as volcanically active because it's not anymore, but certainly it was. I mean, you're right, man. This is goldmine. This is the primo most valuable real estate on the moon are these, or on Mars are these lava tubes.
Dude, and now that we know, we don't know, but we have evidence that says these things are huge, could be very, very huge and stable. It's exciting. It's because you think about, like, how do you build a lunar city? Well, you got to build a lunar city. But if you get this thing and you seal off the top and you seal the entire – you seal the insides, first you have a thing to park your paper-thin RVs inside of there, not worry about radiation, and just pressurize the inside of them like tin cans. And then when you find enough source of oxygen, which the moon apparently has a lot of, you can start pumping that thing full of air, reach pressure, and then, boom, build Philadelphia inside of there.
This so here's the thing is we all have Mars fever, and I think we could say, like, as a society, those are the stories that really inspire us and get us excited. And part of it is because we've been to the moon and Mars is the next challenge, but I think also we're just acutely aware that the moon is never going to be Earth, right? Whereas Mars, you know, we talk about terraforming and eventually making it kind of another Earth. But logistically, like, the moon is such an important proving ground to for the technology. And like, if we can make a colony in a lava tube on the moon, the day-to-day life would be almost identical to the day-to-day life on Mars, except for when you go outside and the gravity is different.
Yeah, I think that, I would say it would be, compared to day-to-day life on Earth, absolutely true. But each one is going to have its own challenges. You know, when you're living in the moon, you know, like you said, gravity, you're going to have much, much reduced gravity. And that might be problematic for living for longer periods of time. You know, when you're a tenth of Earth gravity there, that's one thing. And you're going to think about things differently.
I think it's 1/6 on the moon and 40% on Mars.
So if you look at, like, your gravity is going to be, you know, to the point that you're probably going to suffer some sort of material loss. And also, you're so much lighter. I mean, you're so much closer to Earth, though, too, is that, like, we were sending probes and stuff like that to the moon in the 60s. And so the idea that you're not as remote, like, I broke the microwave, guys. Geez, you know, it's not going for 3 days. Yeah. You break the microwave on the Mars.
Then it's back to the stovetop
and cooking. You're screwed for what, like 5 years until somebody can bring another microwave out?
Well, the supply chain is much, much shorter. And plus also, I mean, if we envision, it's what, like a 3 day trip to the moon? Is that what it is? Or is it 3 days round trip?
No, it was like 3 days too there.
Yeah. Okay. So you're 3 days away. I mean, that makes so much more sense, because it's like you're coming, you're going, you're taking vacations to the moon. I mean, I don't know. It's incredible.
The moon will be like our Canada, you know?
I mean, all right. So this is awesome to think about, but isn't the real question whether or not we can get the technology up to snuff to be able to live in these situations? Like, I mean, like, it's awesome that we would be able to live somewhere else, but it's all about that whole pressurization and living life in the most Earth-like way possible. Like, I guess, like, that's, I mean, like, now as these dreams stop becoming kind of fantasy and start becoming real, I feel like that's where, like now we have to, like, start solving real-world problems. Like, you know, who's going to bring the couch? You know, it's just, like, it's really, really cool to think about.
To be sure. And I think that I like the idea of doing both. And the idea of doing both, of solving the problems of the challenges of Mars and solving the challenge of the moon. Because also, like, you're going to have... There is certain things like, how do you seal this cave? How do you do this sort of thing? And we've been doing things with underwater mining, channel building, and other kinds of stuff where we have tools to solve these problems with. But at the end of the day, survival, you know, how to survive on the moon is going to be very different than how do you survive on Mars, given the different materials that are available.
You're talking about in terms of, you know, in both cases, in as much as possible, you want to live off the land. And obviously Mars, it's very important to do so. If you can envision a vastly reduced expense to get to the moon, thanks to, you know, like the 3-stage reusable rockets from SpaceX or whatever, you can maybe bring a lot more equipment that way. But I mean, yeah, they will be different. But as far as the... You know, from Earth, if we were to see a person living on Mars and a person living on the moon, I'd say like 90-95% of their day is going to look identical.
To be sure, but I think from like a materials point of view, if you're like, well, we can use lunar soil to do this, we can't find these things on Mars. Like if Mars just didn't have metallic materials or things like that, you'd be like, oh man, you know, we're going to be screwed because we can't do certain things there. Versus, I think that like the material difference could make a big, huge. Have a big, huge effect about that, like the availability of water. And in your to the Earth point of view, absolutely. But when it comes to figuring out how you're actually, you know, what are your economies going to be based on, what your survival is going to be based on, it might be very different. But there are going to be a lot of the same questions we're asking. And yeah. I think that, like, and you mentioned, like, you know, making Mars Earth-like. I mean, yes, but then it's going to be its own thing, you know.
So who builds the first lunar tube colony? Like how does this happen?
I would imagine a government, right? Unless it's like a planetary – is it Planetary Ventures, the space mining conglomerate?
Yeah, but they're all just mining asteroids.
Yeah, but certainly like something like that could be put together. Because again, like once the price to get to orbit plummets, so, all of a sudden you get all kinds of speculative.
The idea that it's a factory town on the moon.
Yeah.
Because we're doing some stuff on the moon.
That's what I would imagine.
Yeah, I think that you're going to, you know, you're going to get, you know, Google has their own lunar project where they're like, you know, willing, hey, you know, we'll give you a prize if you, you know, put something on the moon and you can explore it, whatever. And the, you know, you get into, I'm not a believer in trying to build a business model on tourism. You know, I'm all for tourism or space tourism, but you don't want to build, you know, the future of humanity's exploration of the universe on tourism, because that is an extremely fickle beast and can come to a crashing end. You want things that are sustainable. And, you know, Mars is not going to be sustainable for a hell of a long time because, you know, you think about, I'll give you an example. People say, oh, why don't we make iPhones in the United States? Why don't we make iPhones in the United States?
Why don't we make iPhones in the United States?
Glad you asked that, Justin. Technically speaking, you know, we can make an iPhone in the United States in theory. But when you build an iPhone in China, in a Taiwanese-owned factory, and you hire Chinese people to make them and Chinese robots to make them, part of the advantage there isn't just that there's a skill set or they know how to do it. Actually, the skill set belongs mainly to the Taiwanese and the Apple engineers that know how to do this, but because they have a supply chain there. The place that makes your LCD screens or your screens is a mile down the road. The people that make the microchips are 10 miles over this way. The people that make the motherboards are over there. There's an entire supply chain there, batteries, everything. That's all there. Now, you could ship all those parts to here and put it together and say assembled here, but it would take you much, much longer and all those things there. When you talk about doing things on Mars, you know, where do you get capacitors? You know, where do you get copper wire? You know, where do you get some of these basic sort of things? And you think about, you know, what we do when something breaks or whatever, it's, oh, well, I just go order a new one from Amazon. But when you're on another planet and, you know, we can say, well, 3D print it, well, fan of 3D printing. I don't know if you got that memo. there are many, many, you can't make most things with 3D printing. You know, you can't make paper with a 3D printer.
Right. Well, yet. So let's get back to, like, if not space tourism, then what is the draw that makes it sustainable on its own? And I guess one of the nice things about the moon is that we know some of the materials that are valuable there. Like, is it helium-3 that they have? That would make it profitable to set up a thing. Hold on, I'm looking at an old Popular Mechanics article here. It says mining the moon. The price, I think it was like $40,000 an ounce. I want to say there you go. Yeah, projected value of $40,000 per ounce. 220 pounds of helium-3 would be worth about $141 million. Okay, so.
But understand too that's also based upon like present production levels and our ability to find it or get it heat right now. Like, and so I mean it's like antimatter. You know, what's the price of, you know, a couple of molecules of antimatter? It's hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right. Well, and here on Earth we saw used to be that aluminum was one of the that was way more valuable than silver. Napoleon, as a matter of fact, impressed everyone by having aluminum forks and utensils for everyone to use until somebody figured out a way to vastly reduce the, because naturally occurring aluminum is very, very hard to find. Whereas if you have tons of, I think it's clay, and you use some kind of like borax or bauxite, I forgot what it was, but there's something that you can extract all the aluminum out very cheaply, and all of a sudden the value of aluminum plummeted. So you're right in that right now helium-3 is an extremely valuable commodity because it's hard for us to get our hands on, and that wouldn't always be the case. But I don't know that that's a reason to not project that mining will be the first most valuable self-sustaining.
I don't know. I'm reading the Wikipedia where it says current U.S. industrial consumption of helium-3 is approximately 60,000 liters, which you go, okay, how much is that? Well, that's 8 kilograms.
Right.
And the cost at auction has typically been around $100 a liter. So, you know, we start working on that. Like, yeah, it comes out to like, yeah, I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying that we're trying to base an economic model on something that's several steps beyond. And,
well, so it sounds like so you don't agree that it'll be a mining town first. What do you think will be first?
I don't know. I would say that I don't know first. I would say that I don't know. And I'm,
well, that's not the game. The game is we're placing bets.
I'm gonna get to what I know. I'm gonna get to what I do know. What I do know, Brian.
All right,
Brushwood. That is your name. What I do know, as we've talked about before, is that there are many, many materials that are produced in low or zero G environments that are very interesting in certain kinds of manufacturing that become fascinating. And so, you know, I have my little 3D printers, which I love to play with and use. And as we saw looking at those lava tubes, when you have that reduced gravity, what you can do that's really cool, when you start thinking about what happens when you start putting 3D printing machines and things like that on the moon, we have reduced gravity, so you can make things taller, steeper, whatever. And I'm talking about microchips, bubble memory, all sorts of things like that. When you start putting little bacteriums inside of their thing, I think there's going to be a ton of industrial research potentials and a ton of industrial materials that'll be shorter term. You want to talk about making carbon fiber nanotubes and other kinds of stuff.
Oh, wow.
That's where I'm saying, okay, I can wrap my head around that a little bit easier than...
Well, and I can even see, like, let's say theoretically, these are the same kind of materials that you could do on a space station, but it's fairly inconvenient to live at zero G because you can only do it for so long or whatever. But if you figured out a way to do it on lunar gravity, you know, kind of as a middle road before you try to figure out how to manufacture it on Earth, that could be huge.
And you look at like imaging ships like CCD and all that kind of stuff. And one of the biggest revolutions was figuring out how to take one that was on, you know, theoretically not as precise and efficient as other kinds of imaging tips, but having it be good enough and dirty enough and enough pixels enough to make it work fine. You know, where you're like, oh, this can be, we can make this cheaper. And that might be a case like, yeah, perfect environment. You know, we make it in zero G. But you know what? If we make it on the moon in 1/6 gravity, you know, it's still going to be three orders of magnitude better than what's on Earth or whatever.
Yeah. No, I see that. What's your gamble, Justin?
I don't know. I mean, I would think if it is private industry, then...
Boo! Downer! Downer! Get him off the show!
I don't know. I mean, my thought is that it would probably be some... Like, the first thing to do it would be some kind of, like, government cooperative, let's, like, put a thing there that's like a research station or something like that. And then, you know, the idea of it being a private industry thing will happen. I mean, I guess we are rapidly coming to a point in which I feel like people who make rules here on Earth are going to start staking out the claim on who makes rules not on Earth. And I think that if the more this becomes a reality, the more I think it could become, I think it would be a rad NASA thing to be like, hey, look, we're going to do this. This is like NASA's about making stuff on different planets now. Get some.
You know, and a way to think about it too is thinking along those lines is that, you know, oceans are fascinating. We love the idea of exploring our oceans and doing stuff like that. And you know who's done an amazing job of exploring our oceans and built some incredible technologies for surviving at all sorts of different depths?
James Cameron.
Yeah, him too. The oil companies. Mm-hmm. And because once you'll have, like, as we pointed, we'll have these sort of, oh, this will be an interesting sort of thing. Once we figure out, like, no, there really is a margin. We can make 8% on our dollar or whatever doing X, Y, or Z. Then all of a sudden, you know, you put a ton of resources into it, and which I don't think is a bad thing. I think that it's a, you know, done right, you know, it's a very, very helpful thing and helps humanity. I think that, you know, if you know, the hydrogen, the helium-3 production, rather, is – you know, and I think I looked up hydrogen-3, not helium-3. And so we're going to get letters. We're going to get angry. No, I looked up helium-3. I think that we're going to get angry letters about that. No, I think that you're going to see where there's money to be made and demonstrably money to be made. You'll get a tremendous amount of resources coinciding with whatever sort of genuine research we're doing. But it might be like, you know, how we ocean exploration or exploitation today.
Right on.
Gentlemen, speaking of exploitation, I mean exploration.
Waka waka.
Oh, wait a minute. I smell where this is headed. Hang on. Let me type patreon.com/ weird things.
Wrong, Brian. I was totally not going to go there.
Oh, sorry. Well, I'm just going to leave this here where everyone can see it.
All right. I was actually going to go there. We have a Weird Things Patreon. If you want to support the Weird Things podcast, you can go there. Patreon.com/Patreon. Somebody else take over.
Patreon.com/Weird Things.
That's it. 440 patrons. Thank you guys so much. Your support has made possible not only us doing this on a regular basis, but also bringing on the amazing Neshcom as our producer. So thanks for being a friend.
Right. Now, speaking of Neshcom, the producer, he took over a little project for us, a much neglected thing, which was the Facebook Weird Things Com.
Facebook.com/WeirdThingsCom is where I'm headed. Hey, look at this. We're all legit now.
You look at there. Neshcom has been, that's Bryce, by the way, has been posting some interesting stuff. He has, the latest one is A Dead Girl Solves Her Own Murder.
What?
Which sounds totally legitimate. Totally real. He's got an article about the current mission to put astronaut Scott Kelly into space while we monitor his brother on Earth to see how different it is. And some other interesting articles. So he's just started doing that. So if you want to go like the page and follow it, go to Weird Things Science. It's a science website, apparently. Go there, and we'll also be posting the podcast there, too. Now, there's weirdthings.com, of course, but we also have a Facebook. We have a Facebook, guys.
Dude, if you're just a fan of the podcast, why don't you throw us a like?
Yeah, come on over. That it's facebook.com/weirdthingscom.
Nice.
Gentlemen. So we've agreed it's our mission to live in space, right? We're all going to live in space, right?
Sure.
Yeah, man. Hell, I'm ready to go right now.
Yeah. Brian, you going to go live in space?
Well, I mean, I'm going to live in space, you know, to get to Mars, but then I'll live on Mars.
All right, cool.
I don't think if Mars is in
Earth
space.
Earth is mine. it's all a trick all along.
Oh, man. What an elaborate ruse to get everybody to leave so you can crown yourself emperor.
Bye, everybody.
I'll catch up. I'll meet you there. Bye.
Sits in the garage. It's good. It's good. I'll be there. I'm gonna clean up, guys. Take care of some things. I'm like, oh, they're gone. Oh, they're gone. I was like so stoked about the whole premise of the show Last Man on Earth, because I'm like, man, if they can really do a show just about one guy left on Earth, that'll be awesome. If it breaks down into some sort of like there are other people and all that, I'll be disappointed. So guess what show I don't watch?
Man, that's I actually don't know anything about The Last Man on Earth. I'm sad to have even heard that much because I wanted to give it a try. But that's my fault for not.
I'm sure it's a great show. I'm sure it's a great show. But like, guess what? There are other people. I'm like, man, like if they were brave enough to figure out how to make that premise work, that would be awesome, you know. But you know, Night of the Comet did it perfectly. So why touch it? The other people won. So, guys, I don't want to scare you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Seriously. You know, we keep asking, like, where are the aliens at? You know,
yo, where are my aliens at?
And you know, we've offered explanations here every time somebody brings up the Fermi paradox. Like, oh, we'd see their footprints. Like, yeah, how come I don't see, like, you know, the East Indies Company, you know, train tracks all over, you know, the United States? You know, like, well, guess what? You know, we got better ways. You know, it's one of those things where we look at our current technology and our current way of viewing, and when we imagine somebody who's more advanced than us, we just think they're sort of a bigger, richer version of us when they have, like, you know, amazing technologies. You know, like, imagine trying to explain to a conquistador, you know, about, like, ah, I can't get Wi-Fi here.
Yeah, right. Well, and that's the mistake is, you know, that's why retrofuture is so fascinating a genre to look at, because all they're doing is taking what they do now and just multiplying it times a bigger number. You know, like, you know, pre-automobile, if you told somebody that Manhattan or New York would be 18 million people at some point, they would immediately say, you know, well, what do you do with all the horse manure? I don't understand. How do you handle that? And they start going to work solving problems that don't even exist.
So one of the theories about what happens, like in the natural progression of technology, when you start to build things, like there are certain things you look at society as they start to make. Like first, you live in a cave, you know, then you're like, well, I'll make my own cave. You know, I'll make a little temporary structure with like wood and stuff like that. And then I'll make a semi-permanent one with rocks and stuff. And then I'll make more complicated caves with arch ceilings and doorways. And then maybe I'll make I'll bridge one land to another land with a thing called a bridge, you know. And then you move forward.
I love the fact that the verb bridge existed before the noun bridge.
Why touch it? It's a bridge.
Yeah, I mean, geez, let's not be dumb about it.
That.
Then, you know, it keeps going on, and then one brave person suggested, like, well, let's think a little bit further out there, Freeman Dyson.
You know, I know the name. I don't know. He's a mathematician, right? And a futurist and a smart guy.
He may be a mathematician. He could be a physicist.
Okay. But this
theoretical
is, but
physicist and a mathematician. So, yay, we both win.
This is, by the way, this was why they called it a Dyson sphere in Pandora's Star, right?
Well, you just jumped the gun there.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
So he came up with something called a Dyson sphere. Go ahead, Brian. Continue.
Well, no, I mean, I didn't know if this is where you're headed. I just wanted to make sure. I always assumed that this was the reference in question when I read that book. By the way, Pandora Star is an amazing book. You should really enjoy that. But is that what we're talking about? Is the Dyson sphere?
Yeah. Well, we're newer information. So that's one of the Dyson sphere. The idea is that you take a star. If you want to capture all the available solar radiation, you build a bubble, you build a shell completely around it. You seal it away inside of there, right? So people who are looking for aliens, SETI and otherwise, are like, well, if we want to look for super advanced civilizations, people that have the technology capable of, you know, just walling off their entire sun to consume all that solar energy, then what we need to look for? Dyson spheres.
Well, so and of course, the problem with that is how do you look for something that has theoretically no energy signature and no leaking through?
The theory was that there would be a heat signature, and the idea that, you know, you could do the math and say, okay, it would be, you know, like even a black hole gives off a signature. So, you know, assuming that it doesn't have perfect thermal efficiency, whatever, then you should be able to, you know, find some evidence, look for these little hot spots out there and be like, oh, wait, you know what I think that is, guys? I think that's a Dyson sphere. I think we found it. You know, I think we found ancient advanced civilizations there. So that was a thing. But the scientists looked all over wherever they could try to figure out where maybe there might be one. Didn't find any. None. Nothing.
So, therefore, there's no aliens.
Just empty space.
This kind of stuff always seems a little weird to me, because it's like whenever we're inventing the thing that we're sure the other thing that we don't know what they're doing, like that's how we find them. And it just like it's a cool thought exercise. It's rad to talk about, but it always just seems a little like, I don't know, a little too much chasing your own tail. Like,
well, maybe they caught it, guys, because I have an announcement to make.
Wait, what?
What?
No, they didn't find a Dyson sphere. No, just ease down. Sorry.
Dyson vacuum cleaner.
That's right.
They actually got his biography right over here. Different Dyson, but yeah. So they, some scientists looked at it and said, you know what? Like, what if they put it around a smaller one? What about like a white dwarf? What about a white dwarf? What if we just used a white dwarf instead of like a big Earth sun? You know, what if we did that? You know, and that's like a dim version after, you know, sun swells up, feels like big, really proud of itself, and then explodes. But you have this little small white dwarf. And they said, well, the habitable zone is much smaller, much, much smaller, closer to that. So they figure like you would have a much smaller sphere, not the kind that we're looking for. And they could, you know, you could have like a 1 meter thick sphere built in the habitable zone of a white dwarf, right? And it would take 10 to the 23 kilograms of matter, which is, Brian and Justin are about to point out, whoever will be first, slightly less than the mass of our moon.
I was about to say
that. Knew you had it. They say Dyson sphere encircling a white dwarf would also have almost Earth-like gravity, I assume, if you stood on the outside of it.
Wait, that's amazing. So, okay, wait. So if it was a solid structure about Earth-like gravity, you're standing on it, and you just take that energy and use it to power streetlights on top. That's amazing.
Yeah, trying to figure out like
ruin those like digging through the center of the Earth to go to China metaphors.
Yeah, but you know what would be awesome is you build a Dyson sphere around a white dwarf and generations pass, and then some, and then finally this radical new theory comes up that what if the Earth is hollow? And then it's like they mount an exploration to journey to, there's a star in the middle of the planet. Who knew?
So I'm curious, like, what they don't put in here is, like, what is the habitable zone of a white dwarf? Because I'd be curious, because, like, wouldn't it be awesome if it was, like, you know, Jupiter-sized or more or whatever, and you had that much surface area of a planet but with Earth-like gravity?
Yeah, man, there's a lot. I just typed in a white dwarf Dyson sphere, and I'm seeing a bunch of new articles, I'm sure, what you read on this.
Man, we're figuring this is a great – I'm really glad that we started this real estate podcast where we just talk about awesome new housing opportunities throughout the stars.
It is kind of weird that it keeps coming back to that.
It's called a theme, Justin.
It's great. No, I mean, listen, we have a very tasteful tutu in a lava tube, or we can get a nice little bachelor pad on a Dyson sphere.
I mean, I guess that's the difference is we're not talking about academic interests in these things. We're picturing how we will live in them, you know?
Hell yeah. Number one, like, that is a way cooler idea of where you want to live, right? I mean, like, it'd be cool to live on the moon on some level, but it's like, is it as cool as living on a sphere that is encircling a white dwarf? No.
So what about this? If you could live anywhere in the galaxy, let's say that travel technology is limitless. You can cryogenically freeze yourself. You can get anywhere relatively fast. You pack allegedly up your family, and you're just going to live the rest of your life in one place. Describe for me your fantasy space place to live, Justin.
And I remember many long conversations with Andrew about hollowing out asteroids. Like, I feel like feel like a hollowed out asteroid where it's like, that would be rad. Like towns as asteroids. And then, you know, like the high school from one asteroid would fly to the other asteroid to play football. Like that would be awesome.
I really love that actually. And then each one has their own laws. You go to Las Vegas asteroid. Then you know, you go to an asteroid that lives like it's Victorian England or.
Hell yeah. And then there's one where it's like mandatory heroin use or something.
Yes. Amsterdam, the asteroid.
It's an asteroid, man.
Yeah.
We didn't hollow this out to be boring.
Man,
that's one asteroid that's like, no, that's what we did. We're all really boring.
There's a cosplay asteroid where nobody's there'd be like a Harry Potter asteroid where it's like they got all this technology meant
to. There's a Play Cause asteroid where everybody does Bill Cosby impressions.
That would be amazing though. Imagine a world or an asteroid where they use advanced technology to simulate supernatural powers for everything. So it's like that you walk in and the first thing they do is they're like, welcome to superhero asteroid. Here we're going to outfit you with this, this, you have to wear this hat all the time to monitor your neural impulses. And then you go into this city, they've created Metropolis or whatever. And you just think, you know, like, levitate this object with my mind and it starts moving. And of course, what it's doing is the computers are reading your thought. You want that to move.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, hidden maglev technology causes it to move.
Number one, there's no sentence that is, has been spoken that is more awesome in the English language than welcome to superhero asteroid. Please keep your hat on. Here's your hat.
That would be
dude a hat.
I think this is gonna be what we okay. Because I wonder, like, what's the point? Where do we end up? What do we do once we have everything we ever wanted? I think that's what we do. Is we can't actually go back in time, but we could create a 1980s cosplay asteroid where they recreate down Manhattan, you know, down to the polluting cars and everything. In this one area, and you could go and be in 1980s.
Like, think about it like this. We live now in our culture in a very fractalized culture in America and the Western world because of the internet. You can find and ingrain yourself passionately in the smallest little niche and kind of surround yourself in it. It still blows my mind whenever people, and me included, talk about like, oh, Twitter is going crazy about this thing. No, Twitter by and large is not going crazy about the thing you think that they're going crazy about. All your friends
right.
on Twitter are doing it. We have so tailored our own universe. And, you know, when I think about, you know, my family coming over from Europe, like, you know, only a few generations ago, that at one point somebody was like, "Ah, you want to know what? This sucks. I'm leaving. I'm going to the United States. Deuces." Can we be at that point now, like, or in the next like 50 years, that what would be communities that are, you know, holding firm to, you know, making sure that their voice is heard within our culture are then just like, "Eh, I mean, we could just live on an asteroid and just do everything that we want. So deuces." We are coming back to a deuces phase of human culture.
Exodus, right? Yeah.
We could just say, screw you guys, I'm going home.
Well, that's one of the amazing things about, I forget which podcast it was on, but they were talking about how we still very much see the echoes of the kind of people who come to America are the kind of people who are like, I'm going to take on massive amounts of risk. I'm going to abandon everything I ever knew just so I can pursue this. And whether it's, you know, the vision of being rich or wealthy or successful, whether it's the ability to, you know, practice your religion whatever way you want, or whatever your nutty idea is, like, it's going to take a few generations before that smooths out and becomes uniform to where, you know, United States starts to look like Eastern Europe.
Well, but even then, it's like, let's say right now, you know, this whole thing that's happening in Indiana, right, with like the LGBT law thing, and you know, everyone on Twitter, he says hypocritically after he just made his point about Twitter, is, you know, all up in arms about it. Like, you know, but let's say Indiana was its own asteroid. Like, I feel like we look at it differently. It's just like, yeah, all right, I'm probably not going to visit that asteroid much, but, you know, whatever, do what you want, get it how you live it.
But, and you know what'll happen, right? And I guess we're that's interesting, because that's, of course, what United States was supposed to be, is each state, you know, everyone be cool, we're all our own asteroids here, and then slowly everything becomes federalized.
Hey, what are you doing to those people there with the chains around their necks?
You're like, oh, man, that's our business. That's a southern asteroid thing. Oh, all us southern asteroids have different values.
It's vital to the economy.
Yeah. And then... at any rate, I would imagine that you'd see kind of a similar thing. You'd have, I think there would be this explosion of like crazy. See, and I guess the other thing too, is that vision solves so many things, because you really can be a pirate or a trader, a merchant going from asteroid to asteroid. The way we picture Star Wars would be a very visceral, very true reality. You'd have people coming and going. You'd have a wide variety of different cultures that are only a short flight away from each other. You would have,
here's the thing to think about too. When you talk about colonizing asteroids in the asteroid belt, is that the distance around, you know, this is between Mars and Jupiter. The distance from one point to the opposite side of it is humongous, you know, so that you can have some that are close, but then it would be like, you know, traveling, you know, the furthest reaches of the solar system in some ways.
Yeah, I guess so. Like one side of the orbit or of the elliptical. I guess the orbit of the thing. I mean, it's like it might as well, like if you grow up on one side of the solar system, you just know that you will never, ever see the other side. Man, that's there'll be some like crazy explorer who's going to take a 20-year journey, and he'll be like the Magellan who actually made a full lap through the asteroid belt all the way around.
Like, I feel like that's one of those, like, you know, Manhattan, like, how do you control all the horse poop arguments, though, right? Like to even think of our current, you know, idea of travel and lifespan at the point where this kind of stuff is a reality, I feel like, you know, this will all be in many ways subtly and in many ways radically different.
Yeah.
Creed, I've been trying to do the calculations to find out how much surface area there would be on this
white dwarf.
Yeah.
So, what did you find out about how far out the habitable zone is?
I got one estimate to put it at like a trillion kilometers.
Okay. But I guess how many in AU would that be?
Let's see. Well, it'd be smaller than an AU. It'd be significantly smaller than an AU.
Look, I love this. I love the fact that I could just go to Wolfram Alpha and say 1 trillion km in AU.
Which would be way more than AU. So that's the problem. I'm getting bad numbers here.
Oh, yeah. No, that definitely comes up with 6,685 astronomical units.
How many Philadelphias is it?
So, I'll put width of Philadelphia. Welcome to our new podcast. Google it on Wolfram Alpha. Yeah, look at that. Philadelphia is just 1 mile wide. That's amazing.
Wait, really?
Yeah. It's less than a... Wait, Mars feature? No. Sorry. It's doing the Mars feature. Apparently there's a feature on Mars called Philadelphia.
No, that was just that one time that they showed the film Philadelphia.
Yeah. Huh. Per year. Crazy.
And nobody knows what's happening. Everything is going crazy here on Wolfram Alpha. Wolfram Alpha, you're drunk.
He's just giving out gibberish. You're like, Philadelphia. Oh, you mean on Mars?
Oh, my God. Would that be the best April Fool's Day ever if Wolfram Alpha, like, what has come to be known as, like, the most trusted, snap your fingers resource for, big problem mathematics, like, all of a sudden was just like, yeah, okay, well, here's your answer. But also, it's a billion tulips.
It's amazing.
I found an answer.
Okay, what'd you find?
All right.
About 1.5 million kilometers diameter.
Okay, and that's – okay, so 1.5
it's million. Yeah, they say white dwarf habitable zones like 0.1 AU. 0.01 AU. 0.01.
Wow. So if you were going to – let's say Dyson sphere out of the picture. You spot yourself a white dwarf. You're like, yeah, it's a good spot. We're going to throw up a little orbiting station here. We're going to get really, really close. I wonder how much like our version of Earth it would feel like, because it would have to, if you're going to be that close, it'd have to be a small object.
Be great hot water.
Great. Oh yeah.
Oh man, immaculate hot water.
So when you're think about this, Earth's diameter is like 12,000 kilometers. Okay.
Yeah.
So if you have a Dyson sphere with a diameter of 1.5 million, so that's 1,000 times the diameter of Earth, and then you go, you increase that by, your spherical formula, what you're left with is if you're building up – so if you build your sphere, if you build your material all the way around your Dyson sphere, right, so you're going to have a planet that's got 1,000 times the diameter of Earth, okay? When you talk about surface area and room to live on –
yeah, it's unlimited, right? I mean, virtually unlimited. It's how many Earths would that be? Here, let's do. Crap, I can't figure that out. Dang it, we need math people to put it in perspective. How many Earths?
Hey, math people.
So, okay, imagine this Dyson sphere with an Earth-like gravity, this size, 1.5 million kilometers diameter. We could do this number, but I'd love somebody to send it in to us or post it on WeirdThings.com Facebook. How many Earths could you map out on that sphere? How big could you make that? We're not going to have an answer to that question. So
no. You will, person smarter than us, and write into JustinRobertYoung@gmail.com, put Weird Things in the subject line, or go to Facebook.com/WeirdThings.com. And let us know what you came up with.
You guys, we got time for picks?
Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah.
I'll go first. Last week, we talked about how I was reading, or I think my pick was Heroes of the Storm. But I went back to reading Contagious, which was a pick from Andrew. And we had talked about how it was based on or kind of picked up the mantle from Made to Stick. And so now that I finished up Contagious, I'm reading Made to Stick and really digging it. It is a very direct, simple set of characteristics that these researchers have found with sticky stories. And they start off talking about urban legends that are patently false and yet so sticky that we can't get rid of them. Like the kidney harvesting idea that, that, you know, you wake up and your kidney's taken, or the fact that there are zero recorded cases ever of a stranger poisoning candy and giving it out at Halloween. The only cases that ever existed are parents who were poisoning their own children, or trying to like, one was like an insurance, you know, or cover up, yeah, after the fact or whatever. But it's like, and yet that myth is so pervasive. Why is it that it's so very sticky? And so they break it all down. They got an acronym. So it's, I'm not going to be able to remember it because I'm only halfway through the book, but I'm enjoying Made to Stick very, very much.
Awesome. I got two picks. Finished House of Cards on Netflix. I love House of Cards. You know, I think there's, you know, I think reasonable people can have a discussion of, you know, comparing this season to some of the past ones. I very much enjoyed it. And again, it's a show that I don't feel like I can be reasonable about just because how much my favorite sport is watching sociopaths be lists to each other. And like, that scratches that itch so completely. So great job on that. I very much enjoyed it. Check it out. And this weekend, if I seem like, I mean, it's fitting that we had so many space stories because I am right now a space cadet because I have been burning the candle at both ends, doing all sorts of wrestling stuff this weekend. WrestleMania is tonight. In fact, right after this wraps, I'm going to be converting the studio for our WrestleMania live stream, which so you can watch along with us on DiamondClub.tv. But I wanted to bring attention to a short film by Max Landis. You might remember Max Landis from, I think it was that one time on a Weird Things After show where we got a friend of ours to put him on the phone for 5 seconds. But also, probably more regularly, from the Death and Return of Superman short film that he did where he explained that comic plot line and kind of made his own commentary on top of it on, you know, why it was bad for comics, I guess, effectively. It was really well done. The sequel to that has been released. It's called Wrestling Isn't Wrestling. And this time, young Mr. Landis decides that he will take the 20-year career of Triple H, a famous wrestler, and discuss it as if it is, you know, long-form fiction. That this is one man's journey for 20 years and connecting the themes of that stuff. It's really, really fun. And I think you guys would really enjoy it.
That's awesome.
By the way, and this is Max Landis, who we've had on our podcast, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it is.
I said that, right?
That's kind of how he introduced him, yeah. Welcome back, Andrew. We're talking about Max Landis, who was on the podcast.
I would have sworn he didn't say it like that.
No, yeah, he said that he mentioned how
a friend of ours, yeah, put him on the phone.
Put him on the phone for like 5 seconds in Weird Things.
Did you say specifically on this podcast?
Yeah.
Said it was a Weird Things after show because I believe it was a Weird Thing.
Ah, I see.
What is happening? I feel like something important is occurring. What is this?
What is that I hear? What is that sound? What is that awesome ADS John Carpenter-like music that's going through the ether?
Mm-hmm.
That might have been why I was a little distracted. I was trying to find that. Gentlemen, if you haven't seen it, you need to see it. Now, I'm going to tell you this. Some things are subjective. You're like, oh, I like this. Be like, oh, no, I thought it was funny or whatever. I don't care. I don't care, okay? Whenever you say, oh, like, I like this horror movie, people are like, oh, no, I laughed because I'm so brave that I laughed during this horror movie in the security of my own home. And it's like, all right, shut up, okay? I don't care, all right? Like, you know,
man,
I'm not
who
a big
are you, who are you hanging out with, man? This guy sounds
Twitter,
like a real jerk.
Twitter, Brian.
Okay, got okay. it.
Everybody on Twitter does that.
When you say like, oh, have you seen this horror movie? You're always going to be like, oh, it wasn't scary. Well, no, because it's a damn movie, guys. There's that weird thing, this reaction people have to have that. Meh. It's like, listen, I don't care. Like, I'm not a guy that gets really scared when I watch movies. Okay, I may joke that I get really scared, but then again, every now and then I do. Maybe I will jump. Maybe I will be like, oh my god. Okay. There have been, and I kind of tuned out of horror movies because it just got to be just torture porn, repetitive kind of thing where it's just like, all right, that bores me. There's not a lot there. I heard a recommendation of a movie by a friend who I really, really respect, is actually shooting a commercial for one of my trigger clip. And then I was hanging out with Mr. Chris Kenner, friend of ours, who, by the way, has been on the podcast. You know who else has been on the podcast?
Chris Kenner.
He was Max Landis. Did you know that?
Yeah, no, I
did. Yeah.
You did? Oh, okay. Sorry. We should have pointed it out. So
I want to recommend Made to Stick. I think it's a great book. And all right, go ahead.
So anyhow, I went and saw this, and I loved it. It's a small little film. Now, I'm going to tell you, like, I mean, it's like they're like, all right, this could silly. This could be done better or whatever. But overall, it was a great little film. I haven't enjoyed a little film like this in forever. It's called It Follows, which was supposed to go to video on demand last week. But because so many people liked it, they decided to do a wider theatrical release. Don't watch the trailer. Don't go to see the trailer. Don't look at it. Don't know anything about it. I knew nothing, and I enjoyed it. And I had somebody said to me, like, well, I watch a trailer. It doesn't seem that scary. Well, like, you're watching a damn trailer, you know? The less you know, the better. And it's not like Cabin in the Woods the sort of thing, which to me was like, I should have, you know, it would have been better if somebody told me this, because then it'd be like, all right, I'll enjoy it more, you know. But Cabin in the Woods was clever. But no, it is clever in its very own way, tightly put together, shot against the backdrop of Detroit, which is frightening enough.
Terrifying. I had chosen Detroit, and it's like, it's all the little things that just feel wrong. Stuff you just don't see, like giant LED, high fancy pants, expensive billboards that are just broken and left broken.
Did you see it?
What's that?
Have you seen it?
Seen what?
It Follows?
No. Okay. I'm talking about Detroit. So,
and it's done in this sort of this timeless sort of thing. And then they have things like there's not like, which is kind of cool. I mean, you can tell it could take place modern day, but they don't do a lot of things. It's not like, oh, you know, I'm getting texts and I don't know where they're coming from or whatever. It's about dealing with a scary situation, your relationship with your friends, whatever. The soundtrack is kick ass. I loved the soundtrack. And at first you're like, well, this is a little, and then you get into it and then you dig it. Don't expect a normal Hollywood sort of approach towards it. The director of this, by the way, let me get you his name. I thought it was shot beautifully. I thought the casting was one. David Robert Mitchell, he's one to watch. I guarantee you, you're going to find out more about him coming out there. The casting, I thought, was really, really well done. Not since, like, you know, a Brian De Palma sort of thing. And a graduate of Florida State University, mind you. Who would have thought? His last film was The Myth of the American Sleepover. So he likes good character stuff. So anyhow, that's one pick. And then I have another pick.
And by the way, no genre fan, if we were to describe genre art as sci-fi, fantasy, and horror, no one suffers like the horror fan. The people that have that watch just the schlock that gets pandered to horror fans is really offensive and has been for decades. It is awesome when good horror comes out, because when horror is good, there are few things that are better.
And the just understand, like, it takes a premise we're all familiar with and whatever, but it's just a well done. The critics' reviews on Rotten Tomatoes are 95%.
Wow.
Okay.
It's insane, because critics hate horror movies in general. Critics like dramas, they don't like comedy, and they don't like horror.
Yeah, and you'll get, like, super horror fans like, well, it's kind of like this, or this is, like, forget, like the premise is irrelevant almost. It's more about the characters and the cast and all the blah, blah, blah. Anyhow, that's one pick. Another pick. I know, if you're like me, and you've been thinking, like, man, you know, I like Mad Men. I like tech stuff. You know, I really, really like the idea of the Wild West days of the early 1980s, when people are trying to build clean room environments and Chinese walls in order to re-engineer the BIOS operating system for PC desktops in order to open up that entire market and take it away from IBM. And I wish there was a drama that followed that.
Are you serious?
I mean, you agree with me, right? You know what I'm saying?
We've all been there.
You know, cause you're like, man, it's a fascinating point in time when, you know, the PC computer is just this amazing world-changing piece of technology, and IBM Big Blue still controls a large part of the market, all because of one chip, one copyrighted chip that laws prevented people from just outright copying. And then finally some brave individuals figured out that if they could, you know, figure out how to create an operating system that did everything without copying their code, then that would open up the market for clones and change computing as we know it and radically reduce the cost. Eventually the Koreans would take over the market for that period of time. It would be amazing. But who would be crazy enough to make such a show?
This is awesome. What I have no. Wait, is this a theatrical lease? What kind of? Where did you see this?
I think. I mean, I know that there was. I think. Is this the Halt and Catch Fire?
Halt and Catch Fire on AMC.
Yeah.
No. Season two starts next month. Season one. I'm halfway through season one, and it is a TV show about exactly that. About this guy leaves IBM, shows up at a computing company in Texas with the idea of, like, let's reverse engineer IBM's operating system so we can create our own clones, and sets his company on a perilous course. So it's a very interesting. It stars Ronan the Accuser, which
Lee Pace, yeah.
I look at it as one big Marvel one shot.
And he is great, Lee Pace. So this is good. I really hadn't heard a lot from it, which I took to mean that it was maybe not the best, considering the tech circles that I often find myself in. The fact that people weren't doing backflips for it, I thought was maybe a negative sign. But you say good?
Here, it's good. Now, here's the thing you have to have going. You watch it, and you're like, okay, either consciously or unconsciously, there is a formula that they're following that they're maybe trying not to follow. And first off is Mad Men, another AMC show, is that he has this sort of Don Draper-esque sort of back, you know, where is he from? What's his motivations and all that? And I think it leans a little bit too much on that. And I think that the other characters, Mackenzie Davis, she's great. And I think Scoot, the other guy, they're all very interesting characters. I think the Mackenzie Davis character is maybe a little bit too, you know, Riot Girl, you know, to almost make her too much of a cliche, but I think she's a great actress. So I think that we'll see where that settles in. That's my thing. It's like, man, it's like the very limited archetypes that people draw from. We need a programmer. Well, obviously she's like a Riot Girl, you know. It's like, well, you know, maybe women have many different points of view and opinions, and you know, they don't have to have, not everyone has to have these daddy issues that compel them. But anyhow, point is, still very well done. I'm enjoying it. I'm halfway through. And I think the biggest problem with Halt and Catch Fire is the damn name. It's a clever name, but it's too clever.
Yeah, it should be like Computer Show.
Think of
Computer
AMC.
Wars.
AMC, Walking Dead, Breaking Bad, Mad Men. Halt and Catch Fire. What is this, like a military? No, it's about the halcyon days of the early 80s when they were trying to reverse engineer IBM's boot chip. You know,
Computer Cowboys.
You're like, what? And, you know, I was like, no, yeah. So I think that they need a better name, maybe.
Silicon Dreams.
Hey, so I got to follow up on.
Wait. Best thing right now, free for another 10 days on AMC.
Oh, the whole first season?
Oh, get it.
Our first season for free.
Okay. All right.
There's an app that sometimes sort of works, which you can then press play on the app and watch it on your Apple TV or your stream it, whatever, and you can watch it on your other device. And you can watch it from the AMC website. So it is free.
Is it a Flixer? Is it a Netflixer? Usually AMC is pretty good about putting their stuff on the Flix.
If it was on Netflix, I would have said it was on Netflix, Justin.
Hey, did you know that we had Max Landis on Weird Things a while ago? It was really amazing.
I have to point that out. They say it's free for 10 days. I don't know. And then probably it will end up on Netflix. But like, I'm not assuming anything.
So I have to amend my reaction to Justin's pick from last week. Last week you picked The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. And I, you know, sort of indicated that it was just a little bit too structured of comedy for me.
Let's go back. Here's the tape. Yeah, I'm Brian. I don't think it's that funny. Yeah. And well, we're back live.
I have watched most of the episodes now because it's the kind of fare that's easy to put on with Bonnie because it's only a 22-minute commitment and so on. And there are It's still very hot and very cold. Like there will be a very funny episode, and then there'll be one that is just not funny, or you know. But the universally the character, I'm in love with the guy playing Titus. I think Titus is a fantastic character, and you notice that they write the bit like I'm certain he got the gig based on his ability to monologue with himself in an entertaining and I don't want to say believable, but like you go along for the ride as he's chiding himself and trying to talk himself into having the courage to do X, Y, and Z. I just watched the episode where they reveal, and I don't want to spoil it, but it's worth, you know, treating as a spoiler, where they with the trial for the person who kidnapped Kimmy Schmidt, and you find out who that is and you see him in action. I thought that was pretty good.
Who, like, kills it.
He just slays it, just murders it. And
this person needs to do more comedy.
Because yes.
Whatever he does, it's brilliant. It's brilliant.
Agreed. So anyway, I with reservations, I'll say I'm on board with Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, just because it's like when it's bad, it misses the mark pretty far for me. But but if you don't mind rolling the dice, there are some pretty good gems in there.
I'm scrolling through Netflix, seeing what's available right now. I don't see Halt and Catch Fire. Have you guys checked out? It was the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
I was talking to Max Landis when he was on the podcast.
Oh, recommended crap. You know, he was on the show.
What?
Oh, man. We're going to be having this conversation. This is going to be a hilarious joke when we're in our lunar tube hanging out.
I'm just going to point out, whenever I tune out, I'm only trying to find the next topic.
I know.
By the way, tonight. By the way, I believe tonight is the premiere of the Scientology documentary on HBO.
Oh, shoot.
Let me double check on that.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, no, I think it – yeah, no, that's
– No, it's not on yet. I mean, it has not been on it, so –
Man, I might get HBO just in time to watch this.
It's Alex Gibney, right?
I don't know. HBO Go says my Flash is out of date. Guess what, HBO? Your Flash is out of date.
HBO.
That's a great insult. No, your Flash is out of date.
So apparently I think that's on tonight. So that should be interesting.
Sweet. And,
all right.
It'll be a great WrestleMania post-show, folks. You got yourself a nice little Sunday.
Heck yeah.
All right, guys. Someday I'd like to get Max Landis on here.
I'd love to have him on. You know, the thing is
oh, God. Nothing's more embarrassing than getting called out on that. It's been weird. Shut up. Shut up, all of you.
Beautiful. 66 minutes, 32 seconds, Neshcom. That's amazing. I know you've got to run, Justin. I can do maybe a super short after things or... I don't know what we have to
talk on. Yeah, unfortunately, I got people coming over, so I got to start building this studio before it gets more packed in here. But
well, I'm committed.
Committed to the bit. All right.
Show.
Now,
see, look at this. Luckily.
I may not know about freaking Max Landis appearances.
I love you guys.
You said, but when?
Bye, Justin. Well, here, I'll run to the restroom real quick and
not if I go first.
Oh, doggone it. So I'm just going to leave it running right now.
In the meantime, we can play
a little bit of this stuff. We'll be right back. What? Meshcom thinks that's not how I wrote this.
Did you wash your hands?
I did. I do. All right, here we go. Let's get talking after.
All right,
here we go. We're at 69 minutes, Neshcom. Take it away, sir.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Yes, and of course, Justin Robert Young is right here. Oh, no, he had to run.
I'm not keeping score, but I think you're in the lead. The Justin and Brian After Things.
We should start After Things with an attendance roll call. Brushwood, yes. Brian, here.
Brian.
What's on your mind, man?
See the smile on my face?
Is that because you're printing money with your crazy evil scientist lab of robots making other robots?
Actually, I stopped the printers for like a week and a half because I had to finish up a writing project and I didn't want to be constantly like tweaking and doing that.
Oh, dude, that's got to be like a seductive black hole of your attention. Because it feels like work. Like for me, my version of that is managing the comments on YouTube and responding to tweets, because each one is very little amount of time. And you get that little, you know, oh, look at me. I'm managing my social brand. I'm working. And meanwhile, you know, it's great because it feels like you're getting stuff done. And meanwhile, the important projects are just sitting there mounting up.
And then meanwhile, like I got an email from Mark Fraunfelder of Boing Boing, who is like one of the biggest guys in like the maker movement and all that, asking me to be on a show tomorrow, which is kind of like finding out like if you're into making and building things, like you've been asked to go like on the Tonight Show.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. That's the sweet center of the universe in that. And how did that come up, come on your plate? Because people, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who have projects and they'd like to make it onto various podcasts.
I think that what happened here with Fraunfelder was that, and I'm pronouncing his name wrong, I'm sure. I read it all the time. I know we have a friend or two in common, and I think it may have just been that my name came up a couple times.
But it happened totally organically, huh?
I just out of nowhere. I just go, hey, email. I'm like, oh wow,
that's amazing.
That's how I'm smiling. I mean, I'm smiling because of that. I'm smiling. You know, I'm smiling, Brian.
Why?
Because once we finish this podcast, I'm going to get in my car. I'm going to go to my favorite foot massage place, get my foot massage, mm-hmm. maybe a little shoulder massage, mm-hmm. all on the up and up, guys. Okay, just so you know. And then I'm going to get myself a barbecue sandwich. They get this really good barbecue sandwich at Spring Street Smokehouse. Okay. They got this like melted Gruyere cheese that goes over. They drizzle it on there. It is amazing. Like, Andrew, that's conspicuous consumption. Why are you so happy about that?
Maybe you're happy because it's such conspicuous consumption.
Or maybe it's a little victory lap.
Uh-oh. What happened? What victory are you celebrating?
Maybe I finished a book.
What?
I don't mean listening to a book or reading a book.
Yeah. You're like, why didn't you make that your pick?
I finished the first draft, mind you, of a children's book, a middle grade story I've been working on.
Oh, right. Like a young adult thing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, more middle grade than young adult. And like, I will go into the differences at some point if anybody wants to hear that. But it's been a passion project. I had to take a sideline to go finish Name of the Devil, by the way. You can pre-order right now on Amazon.
What's the release date on that?
Name of the Devil is July. And I'm going to tell you a little, I think I may have mentioned this before, we're going to have like a little Name of the Devil. There's going to be an Angel Killer short story coming out featuring Jessica Blackwood before then.
Oh, that's so great.
There's the cover. Oh, wow. They did. my publisher said that we were going to do a cover reveal. I guess they did.
I stole it. I scooped them.
That's hilarious. I got to ask about that. Like, remember we talked about doing a whole social media cover reveal?
That's hilarious.
That is hilarious.
The paperback has not that.
Yeah, that is hysterical. So anyhow, you can pre-order that. And actually, it's actually been doing the pre-orders on that. It's actually really, I mean, it's not like a great number, but it's actually, I'm surprised that
we talked to Scott Sigler about this for like what it takes to get on New York bestseller lists and all that stuff. And apparently pre-orders, it's like a rubber band snapping on the day of release, right? So it's like pre-orders It doesn't matter if you pre-order a month in advance, a week in advance, the day in advance. The day it's released is when all the pre-orders are executed, and it shows up on that day and hopefully rockets up to number one, right?
That's what I'm told by my publisher. So if you want to just make sure that you can count it on that first day or whatever, pre-order it now.
I just clicked and if you're logged in, you can pre-order with one click. I just did the one click pre-order. That was very
easy. Thank you, Brian.
Dude, that's great.
Appreciate it, everybody. So yeah, that's as far as I know. But anyhow, I just finished this kid's book. It's a full-length novel. I'm excited about it. It's got a character that I really, 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 really love and hold dear to my heart that I can't wait to share with other people. But it was one of these things where it just – everything got in the way of trying to finish this book. Like I got, 10,000, 15,000 words into it. Then all of a sudden, Name of the Devil, manuscript – for that fell onto my lap, and I'm like, okay, I need to work on that. I spent several months going over that. My fantastic editor, Hannah Wood, gave me tons and tons of notes and a lot of things to work on it to try and make it better. And we already got our first advance review on it, which was ecstatic, so that was good.
But anyhow, great.
So then I had to go do that, and then that was a long process to do that. And then after I did that, then I had to do a second round. I got a little writing. I'm like, oh, no, we need to do this other check of it, right? I'm like, okay, I did a little more writing, and then I start – then all of a sudden I get – this is like the galley version of Name of the Devil that I had to go through there. And
do you hit a point where it's just hard to want to read your words again?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I joke that, like, because, I can write a book in a week, but, like, to edit it, it takes 3 months, which maybe tells you that I should, spend more time writing them.
Yeah.
It's funny. I got this galley thing, and the first thing I did is I said, well, I have my Green M&M test for the book. The Green M&M test was, I think,
Van Halen. Van Halen's contract writer said no brown M&Ms, and so people would have to pick through it because they knew that there was no way to buy them pre-done that way. So they would show up and they would look at the – and I believe it was David Lee Roth's idea because they knew that if there were no brown M&Ms in the jar, then everything else was likely to be not a total –
yeah,
there's
a way to tell, like, did they read the fine print? So mine, I swear to you, my fine print is, did they get the Diamond Club logo right when I do my special thing?
Oh, that's awesome.
First time they did that, I looked, they left out the symbol.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so now the first thing is like, well, let me see if they got that. Nope, they got it right. So they got that absolutely right. And also like having – we had – when I did my New York talk, we had some Diamond Club members come out and meet. And so the HarperCollins publicity people who I love – got to meet in the flesh actual Diamond Club people. So that was great.
Oh, that's great. So they understand, like, there's a difference between being told, like, no, there's a passionate fan base, this community, they can move mountains. Mm-hmm. You're like, yeah. But it's like when you see them show up, boots on the ground is what matters.
Yeah, absolutely. So I finished this first draft, and I emphasize first draft of this story. It's about a goblin, I'll tell you that.
Oh, right on. Oh, we did. We have talked about this in the past.
Yeah. Tonally, it's between Lemony Snicket and Harry Potter. It's not a magical world, in an Andrew world. I have written some other young adult or kid stuff that's got kind of more magic based. But anyhow, I'll explain it later on. But finally, I finished it. And part of the way I had to motivate, like I had like last week, I'm like, I looked at time frames. I had reasons to try to finish this thing. And then I had a friend come into town, and I'm like, and I had to hang out. I wanted to hang out with the person. I don't get to hang out a lot with them. And so I hung out with my buddy, and then it was one of those things where that weekend that I was supposed to do this and finish up, I didn't get to do it. And, life gets in the way. And I'm like, I don't have a wife. I don't have kids yet that I know of in this country that I'm legally paying support for. And so I can only imagine how much harder it is for other people to find the time, but I found the time. I finally said, Friday, I said, okay. I had to take care of something in the middle of the week, a really cool project, which maybe I'll have more to talk about. But anyhow, I said Friday, like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm not going to give myself this really super big, ambitious, like, you're going to write. Like, I've done, we've done like 17,000, 20,000 words a day. It can set a very unrealistic expectation for yourself, in some situations. So I just said, okay, I know, like, I can do it, doing a chapter, a city. I'm like, okay, do two chapters Friday. Do three chapters Saturday and then do two chapters Sunday, and I'll reach the end and then I'll be ready to go back and revisit with the
– that's the toughest thing, man, is and we've talked about this before. Like for me, the best advice I ever got for writing a book is turn off the monitor because you stop editing – as you write, and instead you just write knowing that you'll go back and fix things later. Mm-hmm. It's important to finish so then you can start revising.
Yeah, and I'll touch on that. I have a thought on that too. And so I said, that's what I'll do. And so I did. I did my two chapters Friday, and I actually way exceeded the words that I needed to do. And then Saturday, I did two chapters, and then I took a little lunch break. And then I'm like, you know what? I'm kind of excited about writing the rest of this. Wrote it, and I said, okay, I've got these other parts I can save till tomorrow. I'm like, you know what? I'm gonna do them Saturday. So I finished it Saturday. Finished that version of it. And again, like, I know where I need to go back in there and do stuff and say, like, oh, this, but I finished the story's there. The story's on paper. I have my first draft of it. I'm excited about it. I may be the only person in the world that loves the story, but that's fine. And now I'm like, okay, now I get to take a break, you know, and I'm ready to jump right into it. But I'm at that point where I have it and I love it. And so I felt very good. But it came down to, for me, was just figuring out, disciplining myself and saying, okay, just do this much this day. You know, writing a book is not hard. Writing a book is not hard for anybody. Sometimes you have to do a different pace than other people. You have 365 days in a year. To write a novel, we'll call it 60,000 words. You know, if you write 8,000 words a day, which is an hour, that's 60 days. That's 2 weeks, 2 months rather. 2 months you can be done. If you can find a Saturday or Sunday there to spend 4 or 5 hours, it happens a lot faster. It's just the hardest part isn't finding the time. It's putting yourself back in the seat.
And yeah. Beginning is the most difficult thing. There's Anthony Robbins' story where he's talking about trying to motivate an older woman to lose weight and start exercising. Like, she really wants to do it, really wants to do it. He's like, okay, just walk, you know, just walk for 10 minutes a day or whatever. And then she wouldn't do it for weeks and weeks and weeks. And then finally, he says, okay, you know what? Let's just drop the bar. All I want you to do is just put on your jogging clothes. That's all. You don't have to run. Just put on your jogging clothes and then wear them for 5 minutes and then take them off. Let's start with that. And then the next time, you know, next week he sees her and he's like, so did you put on your jogging clothes? And she's, you know, cuts him off as like, you're like, I went 12 miles a day or however long. Like, because once she had committed, once she had put on the tracksuit, it felt ridiculous to not do anything. Like, she had begun. She was already on the other side.
Absolutely. And that, it's funny because that's an example I used for myself with working out, was like, I had these shorts that I'd go wear when I go walk. I just put on the shorts. And like that. All right. And as we've read more and more about why we're motivated, you understand so much, like, when you have to make 8 decisions about something, mm-hmm. you just lose your resistance and you want to avoid it entirely. And when we think about a task and we think the enormity of the task, we give up. You know, if I said, you know, said, Brian, go save the world tomorrow.
Where do I begin? Right.
Yeah. You know, I'm like, Brian, just be nice to people, you know, say hello to one person tomorrow, you know. Oh, well, that I can do. For me, it is, I need 3 things. Aside from my master plan of where the book is going to go, I need to tell myself to sit down, open up Scrivener to a blank page, and then with that chapter, have a clear idea of the conflict and have some sort of starting hook. Where does it start? Where is the center to begin this thing from? If I have those things, it's super easy. Everything flows. I stop writing. I reach hesitations when either I'm a little bit, the map is too fuzzy and I don't know how to get to where I need to go. The solution for that is just jump ahead. That's always the solution. I've had that happen several times. I just jumped ahead and I went back.
Just draw a box and write, something happens here and now we're there.
And often you find out, you don't need it. Often you find out that, you know, maybe you need a little bit of just a clarification, but often the story can be even tighter because you didn't waste that time connecting things, which often in movies, it gets tedious because, like, yeah, we know this part here. You know, we know what's going to happen here. So one is, I just say, okay, you know, if I have my plan, I have that, sit down, open up Scrivener, which I write in, open up that page, start with that. And if I'm stuck trying to figure out the right way into it, I get up, I go for a walk, and I just tell myself, all I have to do on this walk is just figure out, you know, what's the center point of that scene and the conflict and where it ends. And then, boom. So, feeling very happy right now. Of course, I will go through the normal.
Speaking of which, I'm sure you want to edit it, but if you're looking for someone who might want to test read, I don't know, maybe a 11-year-old girl who reads everything voraciously, Maybe she's on her sixth lap of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy because that's her new assignment at her school.
I don't know if I can handle that well of an informed critic, Brian.
I'm telling you, she will chew it up in 2 days. And in fact, I what I should do is not even tell her that it's yours.
Yeah. We'll see. Yes, I'm nervous about that. Terribly nervous.
She's the demo, and she is – I mean, she'll – I don't know. Would probably.
I'd love to know, what is she like? What books has she liked?
Oh man, she'll give you that list. So many, but I mean, you know, she read, you know, the Giver and the I don't know, just all.
Here's the thing, like in my research and reading a lot of middle grade, a lot of books, I have found that like. Some of the most popular ones are not well written. Like you compare, and I don't want any names, but there are like series that like are extremely well sold well, but you pick them up and you go, man, this is like, I think Harry Potter is very well done. I think J.K. Rowling really grew with her writing. And I've read other stuff and I go, wow, this is the plotting is just all over the place. This is really written for a 12-year-old boy. Just to throw this thing here, and it doesn't hold up. And there's a reason why kids talk about this book and not adults and stuff. And so it's all over the place. And that's the thing that has me like, man, it's curious. It's a interesting. Now I'm going to talk about, you mentioned before the idea of, you know, preparing yourself for going back to it and redoing it. And that is absolutely important. Writing is not a get rich quick scheme. Writing is not a let me just do this then walk away from it. And that is where bad writing comes from. And I would have people often go to me like, oh, take a look at this. And I'm like, no human should be looking at this yet. Nobody. You know, like, why are you like there may be something good here, but there's so much awful that, you know, you can't see it and you have to prepare. And sometimes people just give up on it and they're like, oh, you find the value because I've given up on it. Well, that nobody will. Marvel has a great track record with movies. You know, you look at the Marvel track record, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Now, absolutely. How do they get good? And you look back at some of the bad Marvel movies and you had some of the same people involved, but they learned. Every Marvel movie, they budget for reshoots. They go into it knowing they're going to come back for a couple weeks and shoot additional scenes. And often, you know, other film companies, other studios, most of them, no, they never do that. They'll be like, okay, we're going to spend $80 million on this. Like, what if we need to fix it? Well, no, we have $80 million. Got to get it right the first time. Doesn't happen. Doesn't work that right. You pray for a miracle. Marvel says, no, we expect it. Get it right the first time, and then we'll look at it. And then if we can make it, we'll find a way to make it better no matter what.
Right, right. So the question is either this money that's set aside will save the film or it will improve the film. But regardless, we're going to see a more Marvel, more polished product as a result of setting this aside.
You know, and Pixar. So Pixar has their approach where they talk about plussing. So Pixar takes this, they take a story and they, you know, the cheapest thing you can do is just put words on paper. That is the cheapest way to start a story. And then before they ever start cranking the computers away to start animating stuff, they've tested that story over and over and over again until they think, yes, we have it. Then they start to make it, and then they keep going back and going, what could be better? What do we need to improve? And that's it's a long, long process, but it's why most Pixar movies, you know, stand the test of time. They're great. They've been attacked from every point of view. How do you make it better? How do you plus it? And so, you know, your goal as a writer is, and my goal is like, okay, let me tell the story. Let me create the character. Now let me go back, and my first draft is going to be, what are all the little threads that I need to tie up? You know, it's not just how to, and the first draft isn't just like, I don't consider it just, oh, it's the version I haven't edited. There's a lot of little things. And later on in the book, I'm like, oh, you know what? It'd be interesting if I pointed this out about a character here, or I have an unnamed person that does something here that's not a major character, but I can put them back here and assign something to them. Or, okay, this is much more clear. So there are all these little things that you should think about. So.
Yeah, man. Doggone it. I'm actually looking at the time. I think we're about to start dinner. We could do a couple more minutes, I guess.
Massage and barbecue. Any questions we have in the chat room? Anybody want to know?
That's a good one. By the way, Spearmint Nitrate points out that there were like 30 animatics for Toy Story. I actually had a whole bunch of health and diet stuff I wanted to chat with you about, but I'm afraid that it'd open up more time.
Is that a hint? What?
No. For me, because like I'm I did really well for January, mid-January through mid-February, and then I went out on the road, and then South by Southwest happened, and I basically just undid all of the good work I had done. So I'm back to having, you know, that bounce is completed. And so now I'm starting, like, just to shake things up, like just a two-week highly restricted diet and, you know, whatever exercise I can manage. Like I'm basically factoring in now that I'm going to be too tired to even try to run. Like I'm going to write, if I walk for an hour, that'll count. But the reason I was thinking about it is, I don't know if you've ever listened to Penn Sunday School, but he's been talking about his weight loss and the work of Ray Cronies, basically chill your body to burn more calories thing, where you know, wear a vest made of ice and so on. Mm-hmm. Have you read anything about that? Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I've read some stuff about, like, even like what the difference is of drinking really cold water and yeah, sure. In the long run, it's stupid. You know, I mean, being the point of view that. Is this something you're going to do?
Is this a lifestyle that you're going to do for the rest of your life or whatever? Yeah.
And like the biggest changes that I made that stuck, the thing, and you've read more about, like, you know, how habits form and stick and all that. You finished that book. I got
bored. Yes.
The biggest changes in my life were, one was switching to diet soda from regular soda, and we can make an argument that should get off of soda entirely, but
again, there's the perfect, and then there's the good, right?
Yeah, and then you're like, oh, but you still, you know, there it still has calories. I'm like, yes, but it is less than regular soda. I watched myself drop like 8 pounds when I made that switch. When I switched, and this is, you know, granted, I was,
and by the way, 10 years ago. How quickly do you adjust to, if not liking, then, you know, possibly preferring the one? Like, I'm at the point now where it's like I dislike the feeling on my teeth of sugared sodas at all.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm the same way. Like, yeah, my dad would always drink Diet Coke, and I'd be like, how can you drink this? It's battery acid. And then when I realized, like, man, I looked at how many Cokes I consume today, I'm like, wow, that's 500 calories right there that I don't need. And so what I did was it really happened at Outback Steakhouse. I just order a Diet Coke with my meal, and I would only drink it when I had food, and so I was not as paying attention to it, you know. And so that was a big change for me. Like, I noticed that, like, it was just an easy 5 pounds gone just you know, in a few weeks of just doing that. Then to lower my soda intake, I don't have soda in my house. Oh, every now and then I might bring a bottle home with, like, I mean, the dark side of how Andrew finished his book was Andrew has an addiction, and Andrew sometimes, to get himself to sit down at the keyboard, has to, like, take a very – he puts a bag of Skittles there.
To lure himself.
Andrew may have consumed 1,000 calories of Skittles Friday night.
Wow.
But anyhow, thing to cut down my soda consumption is I stopped keeping soda in the house. So now I have – I'll go out to eat, I'll drink soda, I'll drink that. Now I'm trying to, like, I don't drink it, like, after, like, 9 o'clock or whatever. So that was a big thing. But I'll drink, like, a lot of Diet Coke when I go out to eat, which is not good. But now the next step is I have a big glass of water. When I take my soda cup and I go to the fountain, I fill it with water before I drink my soda, which lowers the soda. Because you don't want to be drinking soda when you're thirsty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you want to be drinking water. So anyhow, that was step. So biggest factor that affected me, switching away from sugary drinks to diet beverages,
mm-hmm.
big, huge effect. I was finding myself in the middle of the day extremely lethargic, very, very lethargic.
Wait, and I'm sorry, say that again?
Lethargic.
No. Wait, in what situation are you lethargic?
Middle of the day. Just middle of the day and be like, maybe I need a nap. And I'd be like, yeah, I've been sitting around all day. Yeah, it was really a hard day. That's time for a nap. And what I started to do was I would get up and I'd go to the park and I would walk for an hour or two hours. And I got into the habit of every day going for a long walk. It did wonders, one, for my health. It was another 5 or 6 pounds was easier to keep off doing that. That solved that problem. Creatively, my most creative work has happened when I'm out there just walking and thinking. And that was a wonderful thing. That was the thing that I still do to this day. I try to walk at least 3 miles a day, every day. Like that is my average for, so, like, looking at my average has been, yearly averages have been that. After, like, Thanksgiving or something like that, I've done, you know, 10 miles a day or whatever. And I love it when I find a really good audiobook, because then I don't pay attention to the time.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, actually, my daily average for the year is 3.5 miles a day.
I think this week's, maybe it's last week's, Freakonomics episode is where they talk about bundling, you know, satisfying things with things that you know you ought to do. They interviewed people where they used audiobooks as the way to lure people to the gym. They took students, they're like, here's your audiobook that you're listening to. You can only listen to it while you're at the gym. And then they tracked how often they showed up. And in some cases, they made it to where they couldn't physically listen to the book unless they showed up. Other times, they gave them the iPod and said, just try to only do it when you do the one thing. And it's fascinating stuff.
Dude, you look at the total running time of how Star Wars Conquered the Universe.
All of that was spent walking.
All that was spent walking.
Yeah.
And so I'm a big believer in that. So I would say diet. The diet drinks was a big help. Walking was a big help. But another big thing for me was like I have a sweet tooth and I have that. A big change up for me health wise is I hate vegetables. I'm not a fan of vegetables. But like I go to there's a place called Daphne's California Greek. I ate there like every day and like I get like a double helping of their vegetables. They're really good. And so I don't tell myself I can't have this or I can't have that. I don't get into that. Oh, I'm dieting. I can't do this. I just, you know, there's much better word choice of I don't do this is much better than saying I can't. But then I say, okay, I like Panda Express. So what do I do when I go to Panda Express? I don't get the rice. I don't get the noodle. I get a big, huge heaping helping of vegetables. I still hate broccoli. I still hate them. I force myself to eat it all. And then I dig into my orange chicken or whatever. And it makes a, what for many people is a 2000 calorie meal into a 700 calorie meal for me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Well, so anyway, I'm starting a 2-week kind of reboot to see. I want to see how drastic, I mean, almost to fasting levels. I want to see if it's possible to clock in at under 1,000 calories and work out.
I think it's an interesting experiment, but like, I know I can go from where I am to my optimum, like the best ever I've been in like 5 weeks. I know that if I want to go like in muscularity, whatever, I know in 2 weeks I can lose. You know, I could probably lose 10, 15 pounds without looking like I was surviving radiation. But I'm just I the problem with those sort of things, they don't solve the long term problem for me.
No.
They,
and it wouldn't be a, I mean, the sustainable thing is to, you know, have I mean, the habit of exercise is now built in. It's what I need to do is, I mean, partly because I got a gig in 2.5 weeks that it would be pretty rad if I was 3 to 4, 5 pounds lighter for. And then,
well, that's easy. You can do that. That's no problem.
Yeah. I mean that, but the biggest thing is I need to, cause my biggest problem is I have a really hard time falling asleep. So I tend to drink beer late in the evening. And then, you know, in order to get tired enough, you know, if, especially if we're doing like Night Attack or whatever, and it's like, you know, a beer an hour for 5, 6, 7 hours straight adds up to a lot of beer. And just that sort of natural unwinding flow has to be broken. You know, I talked to Bonnie. I'm like, look, you know, for the next 2 weeks, it's going to be no booze, you know, around 1,000 calories a day. And it, now understand a side effect of that will be there will be some night that I'll lay in bed. I'll go to bed at midnight and I will not fall asleep until 4 a.m. And
how much do you pay attention to your sleep hygiene?
A lot. I mean, part of the problem is it's inherently difficult to do the things that we know are associated with sleep. Cause what matters is you should have regularity, which is difficult when, you know, two nights a week I've got, you know, live streaming things. And occasionally there's an on the road show where, you know, it's like, and when you come off of a performance at 10:30 and you pack everything up and now it's 11:30, you finally make it back to the hotel or you finally shut everything down. You can't just be like, and now let's go to sleep. So it's like, it's inherently variable.
You know about the whole no electronic screens and all that stuff.
Yeah. That's the biggest thing is I think what I'm going to do over the next 2 weeks, again, as part of the whole lifestyle snap around thing is I'm going to, it's been years since I've made a habit of reading before I go to bed, an actual book. So I'm going to sit and start reading a book because what I have been doing is always audiobooks. But at any rate, so yeah, that'll be, I'm going to try good sleep hygiene and figure out if I can kind of break that reliance on having beers to get me tired to go to bed.
Sounds like a good plan, Brian.
Yeah, for a whole bunch of reasons.
Brian, I see a book in the writing.
how I stopped drinking beer and everything was awesome. Yeah,
not so many beers to go to sleep.
Yeah. It's and if anyone hasn't had insomnia, man, it is brutal. I mean, I am very aware that is not a healthy lifestyle choice, but if it cuts 5 years off my life, but I spend more of it sleeping well, then that's fine. It's like, it's sitting there, especially when you get your head caught in space, like laying in bed, especially when it's, and it seems to strike when it's most important for you to get good sleep. Like, I got to get up. I got to sleep. And you can't. And you're just caught in that loop. It's miserable.
If it's not the caffeine that keeps me up, it's the stress about, like, oh, if I got everything figured out, you know, and like, my reassuring thing, my safe place is I get up and I go look at a spreadsheet.
Oh, really? Like to let you know that everything's all right?
Map out, you know, projects, income, all that sort of stuff. I'm like, okay, I know this is working on. I know this is, I'm doing this. And like, yeah, no, I know I'm worried that, you know, what's going to happen in March of 2016. You know, I need to be worried about, you know, what projects are going on there. But sitting down, going to look at my spreadsheet and going, okay, this is here. I need to be sleeping right now, you know. And that's the thing I often do, is because you get that panic at night because you're like, oh my God, you know.
That's part of the reason that I want to do this, you know, kind of really intensely for the next 2 weeks, is because there's nothing that's hypercritical. Like if I do have one of those nights where I can't fall asleep until 4 a.m., I could put a note on the door and Bonnie will know to do her best to let me sleep in until, you know, 10 or whatever to get that sleep.
Yeah.
So I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. I'll report in next week.
Yeah, I didn't go to bed till 6 this morning.
God, so jealous. Kids changes all
that.
No,
not that. I just was just that, finished the book, and then, I don't know, maybe somebody had themselves a big piece of red velvet cake and a chocolate chip cookie. You know?
You and I have very different vices.
Yeah, I know. Igloo, you know, that's an interesting theory on how you go to sleep. And I always thought, like, man, you know. You know, I want to see the clinical research on that.
Right on. All right. Well, hey, speaking of food, I believe there's some waiting for me downstairs.
All right. Goodbye, y'all.